Willkommen zu einer Sonderfolge des Bücherpodcasts von der Frankfurter Buchmesse. Die amerikanische Autorin Jill Lepore ist mit dem Buch »Diese Wahrheiten – Geschichte der Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika« auf die Buchmesse gekommen. Sie spricht am FAZ-Stand mit Tobias Rüther. Das Gespräch ist in englischer Sprache.
Guten Nachmittag vielmehr. Herzlich willkommen am Stand der Frankfurter Allgemeinen Zeitung. Mein Name ist Tobias Rüther, ich bin stellvertretender Ressortleiter des Sonntagszeitungsfeuilletons unserer Zeitung und bin heute hier, um am Stand auf Englisch, deswegen switchen wir gleich die Language Codes, Jill Lepore zu interviewen. So please welcome directly from the States, Jill Lepore.
Thank you very much.
Jill Lepore is a professor for American political history at Harvard University and a prolific writer of essays, literary criticism, and personal histories, mostly for The New Yorker, but not exclusively. She's a very sophisticated writer, both passionate and bulletproof academic. We're going to talk about this later. and she entertains a very personal, witty, and entertaining and smart style of writing. And I remember very vividly, and I urge you to go back and find it online, a personal memory of losing your best friend Jane to cancer, which appeared in July in The New Yorker. Very touching piece that shows how easily you move between academic writing and personal literary writing. Her list of publications is so long, and awards even more, that I will not even try to get into it. But let me just say that Jill Lepore wrote a cultural history of Wonder Woman, which I always wanted to read, but then the movie came out, so that was easier. and at the same time, a history of slavery in New York, which got the Pulitzer. So the range of interests that you have is pretty, pretty far. But we are today here to talk about your latest book, a History of America, called These Truths, Diese Wahrheiten, which came out at with Beck Verlag in Germany. And it's basically very exciting to have you here. So thanks again for coming. And I forgot to mention that you're a Boston Red Sox baseball fan.
Yeah, I am a Boston Red Sox baseball fan until this year.
Okay, why is that?
Because they were terrible.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a disaster. No, I'm still a fan. They're very disappointing.
Okay. Not much of baseball in this book, but a lot more stuff that we need to talk about. This book goes all the way back to Columbus and goes all the way up to Donald Trump. And let me just start with a very simple question. To write an American history, where do you start? I mean, there's so much stuff out there. Where do you start and how did you start?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's really exciting to be here. That is it's a tough question. Not only kind of where do you start, how do you fathom the project, but also where do you begin the story? Because this is a narrative history and it's meant to be a page turner. You want the reader to really want to read every page and not consult it like an encyclopedia or something. Because I was really committed to the idea that in an age of very fast-paced news, almost all of which seems to me completely inexplicable, you know, day to day, why did that happen? That taking your time and reading a very long, it's a deliberately long book.
Okay.
And slowly, and taking it all in was important. But the question of how to shape the story is a question I had asked in teaching all the time.
Okay.
When you teach American history, you have to ask, well, what am I going to do on the first Tuesday? And what am I going to do on the last Friday? And I had sort of thought about that question of shape, the shape of the story for a long time. So that really helped when I sat down to write.
But this is meant to be a popular history of the American. So like the common man, so to say, the famous common man is supposed to read this?
Yeah, I really had the idea that there used to be a whole tradition, certainly in the United States, but in many parts of the world, of the sweeping, epochal national history. And every historian at a certain point in their career, as a sort of civic duty, would write such a thing and offer it up. And, you know, then it would age out. People would argue against it. But that each generation of a nation state kind of needs some account of how the country got to be the way it is and mm-hmm. where it came from. Mm-hmm. But and that had really gone out of style.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought our public conversation about what the United States is, what it is in the world, kind of needed such an account. Even for people to disagree with, there needed to be something there that occupied that space that wasn't some cockamamie political argument.
You can identify some leitmotifs right away in this book. And the most prominent one is this, as you put it, this nation is built on a contradiction. These truths are self-evident that all men are created equal. When these words were put down in 1787, this wasn't true for a lot of people living on American soil. And you stick to this leitmotif, so it appears all over the place, all over these 900 pages, that there's this inbuilt American dilemma, how it was put later. It has... So will there ever be a solution to this problem, or is this the American history that we have to live with forever?
Well, I think the struggle is the history. Mm-hmm. And if there were a solution... that would be a weird utopianism that we probably wouldn't like. This struggle's important. But the one reason the book starts well before that moment, centuries before 1787, is to ask, where did those ideas come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Thomas Jefferson said they were self-evident, but they came from somewhere. They weren't written in another era. They weren't written by another people. They were later, they become part of the UN Declaration of Human Rights by 1948. They propagate and diffuse, but they came from somewhere. So the first, third of the book is trying to explain, where did those ideas come from? Why were they so not wholly realized when they were first written down in that way? In the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution? And then what have the subsequent centuries been by way of a struggle to live up to those ideals? So if it were a novel, that's the plot. The plot is the birth, rise, and potential death of those ideas.
And the plot moves on from the fate of the African slaves to the fate of the Native Americans, to the fate of the Chinese, to the fate of the Japanese, to the fate of the women struggling for their right to vote. So it's kind of interesting how it's a very entertaining and riveting read. So you really plow through this book, and you have all kinds of heroes and villains, and it's very funny, like colorful characters. But at the same time, you keep coming back to this inbuilt injustice. And I wondered how this is perceived in America, because right now the it's all about making America great again, and you sort of say, no, wait a minute, we should go back and look at the stuff that happened.
Yeah, so we have a kind of split in the United States between accounts of the country, the sort of make America great again accounts, that see the United States as a kind of, the march of triumph.
Mm-hmm.
And the decline is quite recent. But everything else in the past is beautiful and glorious. And then there's another tradition that is sort of a litany of atrocity.
Mm-hmm.
Everything America has ever done has been a form of genocide or atrocity. And those two accounts never speak to one another. And they map on pretty well to the extremes, the political extremes in American politics.
Yeah.
But of course, the truth lies very much in the middle there, where the United States has done magnificent things in the world, and its ideals are shining and beautiful and inspiring. And American history is full of ingenuity and invention and integrity. But it is also true that it is a story of genocide and enslavement and of conquest and of continuing ongoing inequality and brutality, and that needs to be reckoned with. So what I wanted to do is build a bridge between those accounts, suggest the inadequacies of both.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a tradition in the United States of sort of reckoning with our history.
Mm-hmm.
There are kind of calls for reparations, for some kind of financial payment,
right,
regarding the history of slavery. There are ongoing struggles of Native peoples to achieve sovereignty and become Native nations. But we don't have a public conversation about that the way other countries often do, the way this country has had, for, of course. So this book isn't a sort of like truth and reconciliation account. It's a, let's understand that it's a hard road to understand that your national past is full of courage and also cowardice, but that is most countries' national pasts.
I found it especially touching the way you described Franklin D. Roosevelt, obviously one of the positive figures. I shy away from saying that's one of the heroes of the book, who was steadfast and had principles, and at the same time he created another injustice by the way the Americans treated the Japanese part of the population. So I'm not saying that you intentionally try to tell like a black and white story of we did this good and this bad, but it's more like that I had the feeling that you looked at the sources closely and realized, okay, it was always there. So what I found really touching was reading about George Washington, who lost his teeth and had one of his slaves and took one of his slaves and they pulled him the teeth of the slave and then he wore them, which is kind of like a detail which goes to show how it was. Like at the same time, a great president, but...
Yeah, so one of the things I tried to do, because it's a demanding book in the sense that there are a lot of ideas.
Okay.
And there are a lot of political movements, and it's a lot to keep track of. And so I used really parables, essentially, as a mode, right? That story of George Washington and his teeth is, it's like Joseph and his many-colored cloak.
Okay.
It's a parable.
Okay.
And it's meant to be something that will stick with you, as I'm glad to hear it did. And often those parables involve not presidents, but ordinary people who carry around big ideas and that you're likely to remember because they're really interesting characters, compelling characters. Mm-hmm. And again, that's what sort of drawing on the conventions of novelistic writing. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to have people carry ideas ahead instead of having a paragraph carry an idea. Mm-hmm. You know, it's attached to a person, like little carries it around in a little suitcase. So then when I recall ideas, I can recall them through those characters. So there's a lot of work like that involves women and people of color as very important political actors. Yeah. This is not a history of every American president. You know, I find that utterly uninspiring and unedifying as history. This is really about how political and social movements shape the history of a nation.
Yeah. And it's striking, you talk about World War II, and instead of mentioning battles and all kinds of decisive moments, you deal with domestic politics and talk about how women's rights were, how the role of women changed during the war and then changed again afterwards. So this is kind of another leitmotif of the book, that you're not writing about great white men, so to say. You look very closely at social movement, technology, progress, and it's always like more progress, more problems. So it's a different, that was what really struck me. It's not that you look at, it's a question of perspective. And once you change the perspective, you end up with a completely different story of the United States of America.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, you know, and that rests on other people's scholarship, the great work that I'm drawing on there. But for instance, we think about the heroism of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, incredible acts of courage and bravery on the part of, you know, protesters and activists, especially young students. But it's also important to remember that the federal government moved on civil rights because of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Because the United States' message to the world was, we are the free world. and the Soviets said, but look at, you have segregated restaurants. People are divided by race in, you know, using water fountains. You know, you can't go into the post office and post a letter if you're a black person, except if you go over to this one special corner. How is that the free world? And you can kind of trace within arguments within the federal government, you know, we actually have to do something about civil rights if we want to have any credibility internationally. So it's not that it's artificial almost to separate those two stories. So that's the kind of perspective that's important, which none of which is to denigrate the importance of the struggle domestically, but to understand that it also took place on a national, on an international stage.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see that the Soviet Union enters the picture very lately. Like, I was waiting for, like all of a sudden Stalin is there. But you were the only one
waiting for Stalin.
No, but that's another thing that you tell the story and there are all the major events, but you look at it completely differently, or not completely differently. You find sources that are just so telling. Like, I was just thinking about this quote, speaking of segregation, that you found a quote of a black woman saying about the role of American soldiers in World War II. So we die together, but we can't eat together. And these are the moments where you have sort of like, that's an insight in a situation that has always been there, but it's a way of dealing with it and just showing it that this is the manifold and difficult, complex history of the United States.
Yeah, and it's a way to hold on to that contradiction, the American dilemma throughout the story, because it's important not to lose sight of that. I think it also gives strength to this, the United States is in a terrible moment in its history right now. And there's a lot of political despair and helplessness. But there have been other terrible moments. And beneath the terribleness are all kinds of people with goodwill and capacity for ingenuity and for reinventing and renewing the civic tradition of the country. So it's important to see that the past was not all great, nor was it all horrible. Because otherwise, how can you proceed forward acting, knowing that you and I have parts of us that we're not happy about and parts of us we're proud of, but that's how things are.
I wondered if these truths, how old is the title? Because nowadays, like in the light of what's going on in the White House, these truths, there's a different tone to it ringing.
Yeah.
Like, how old is the title?
I know, everything sounds different. So yeah, I was originally wanted to call it American History from Beginning to End because I thought that was funny. Well, it made it seem like a storybook, like a children's fable.
Yeah.
And it would be like a book you'd like to have because you would never have to study American history except for you could just read the one book.
Okay.
Like then it looked like a box, like you could contain it. And that was when the book was going to end with, in 2009, when Barack Obama became president.
Okay. I was about to say that in this New Yorker piece I mentioned, you say every historian is a corona. So it was
But then when Trump was elected, American history from beginning to end suddenly didn't sound funny. It sounded like it was an indictment of Trump. It was like an attack on Trump.
Right.
And the book's not. It's not engaging in political warfare. Mm-hmm. So that was untenable.
Okay.
So these truths, I'm happy with it because it is actually an important moment around the world for us to, as you say, there's a lot of history of technology in the book and a lot of our struggle with how we can know anything and know whether things are true has to do with shifting history of technology. So that begins in the very first page with Columbus and his logbook. What does it mean to write something down, leaving it impossible for people, for indigenous people that he met to leave a record behind that could compete in the historical record. So, beginning with writing, I think about the power of technologies of communication and how do we know things and what survives to tell us what really happened.
Mm. I found myself wishing for a history of your American history because I wondered how you... Because this has been it's a major achievement, and I guess you've been working on this for a very long time. And then Trump happened, and all of a sudden, certain words ring differently, certain aspects become much more prevalent and important. So I wondered how long did it take you, and how did you at some point decide, well, I have to cover this and this because it's getting more and more important?
Yeah, so I had written more than half the book when Trump was elected. And all that it changed was that I had to add the last section to get to through Obama's presidency and to that election. It is the same book I would have written either way, but it reads differently since Trump. Mm-hmm. So I often hear from readers who say, wow, I really loved your book. I can't imagine how you wrote it so quickly because it explains everything about Trump. And I'll think, I didn't write it that quickly. It took me years. This is actually just what happened, you know. But I think things like when the U.S. wants to annex Mexico in the 1840s, and Southern slaveholders say, we can't annex Mexico because this is a white country made for white men, and it's a white man's republic, and we couldn't have those Mexicans become citizens, and we don't want to have another class of citizens. That sounds foreboding and ominous in this moment. But that was in the book long before this moment. Do you know what I mean? Like that, it just sounds differently. Because there were plenty of people that argued against that and said, you know what? Well, I mean, not that annexing Mexico was necessarily a great call, but said, that's not the problem. The problem is we shouldn't just take this country. Maybe the critics of the Mexican-American War, like Henry David Thoreau or Frederick Douglass, would have leapt off the page and sounded prophetic for declaring an end to American empire. If we had a different history since then, but it is the same history.
Right. German historians just started a long debate. It's still going on. They came up with a resolution, thinking about the role the historians should play in the discourse of the nation, and should they promote a critical attitude towards history, and what's the role of the historian in society. And now you just mentioned that the American story is completely different because there's no such thing in the extent that we have it here as a national discourse. So we are talking about Peter Handke right now, and we are all about debates, but America is a different story. So I wondered, is this, in the sense that you have activist judges in the Supreme Court, is this an activist history in the sense that you want to interfere, you want to point out, you want to be critical, because that's the role of the historian nowadays when facts have such a bad press?
Yeah, I think that it's not quite that. I think it has a lot of ambition around a call to inquiry, a call for the importance of historical study, not as a kind of ancestor worship or as a kind of denigration of everybody who ever lived and died, but as a form of humanistic inquiry that happens to be necessary in a democracy. That, you know, the United States was founded during the Enlightenment as a political experiment, as an act of inquiry. And the obligation of a citizen in a democracy is to inquire into the state of affairs in order to cast a vote that is in the interest of everybody, not in your own self-interest, but that is an informed decision about everyone. And so it was always understood that the study of history was necessary for citizenship in that respect, right? Certainly to run for office or to have a position in government, you needed to understand the past. And we don't have a tradition of that. We have a tradition of tourism. Like, you should go to Thomas Jefferson's house and dress up with a tri-cornered hat and a wig. Or, you know, we have a tradition of protest of the past, but we don't actually have a tradition, a sense of civic commitment to the study of the past. And that is what the book, to the extent that the book is a call, it is a call for study.
There's a great quote I'd like to share with you. You call the history of the United States a stirring, terrifying, inspiring, troubling, earth-shaking epic. And I cannot come up with better words to describe your book because it's at the same time troubling. But then again, you have these great moments of great people, like Jane Franklin, the sister of Benjamin Franklin, or like all the suffragettes, Roosevelt, Obama, probably Clinton to some extent. So, but it's not a book of big people. That was not your intention, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's really meant to be full of surprises, and I hope some delight and also some anguish, right? But it's funny because I wrote the book, but I'm also weirdly a reader of it because it took so long that when I remember when the publisher sent me the page proofs to read, I kept texting my husband as I was reading. I was like, look at this. Did you know that this happened? Because I had forgotten it. Like, it took so long, and I had found such weird things that I didn't know before that they didn't stick, you know. So when I read it, I was like, oh, my goodness, this is really interesting. So I had this weird, weird experience of the book because of my very bad memory.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for this book. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon. Thank you, Jill Lepore.
Thank you.